I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm really afraid to look at the front page of the New York Times these days. Iraqi looters steal radioactive materials. Iran is building a uranium plant. North Korea has defiantly resumed its nuclear weapons program. These newspaper reports are examples of what Jonathan Schell calls the coming of the second nuclear age, a disturbing new era of nuclear unpredictability and possible worldwide destruction. In his latest book, The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence and the Will of the People, Mr. Schell suggests that it's time to reject war as a final solution and look to international cooperation as a means for peace. Jonathan Schell is the author of many books, including his best-selling Fate of the Earth. He's been a contributor to The Nation, Harper's, and The New Yorker, among many other publications. His latest book is published by Metropolitan, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to the show.
Great to be here.
So why did you call it the unconquerable world? It seems like this is a world that's easily conquered.
Well, if you look at the 20th century, every empire that existed at the beginning has bit the dust with the possible... I mean, think of it, the British, the French, the Dutch, the Thousand-Year Reich.
Well, the U.S., some people say, was an empire because we had the Philippines and we had other... countries that, but we've always denied being an empire.
Well, as I say, but with the exception of one, and it looks to me as if the United States is seeking actually to reinvent imperialism for the 21st century. But when I say unconquerable, what I mean is that there's a lot of historical experience that suggests that there's something in this world that does not love an empire, and I don't think that that force has expired. And so I don't think the outlook actually for an American hegemonic order is very good, and I think it's going to bring great suffering to this country and the rest of the world trying to achieve it.
You claim that the concept of war is undergoing a metamorphosis so thorough that its existence has been called into question.
Yes, I do think that, and that's very counterintuitive in the light of today's news. More particularly, what I believe is that war has become, in increasingly wide areas, dysfunctional as a means of achieving political ends. Let me be very specific. Let me apply it to the Iraq War. There were two things. I mean, you can fight a war. You can go in there and bomb the place, and you can defeat the opposing army, as the United States did so handily in Iraq. This is a doable thing in certain circumstances, and this was one. But look at what the objectives were of that war. Number one was to stop the spread of weapons of mass destruction. Number two, a far second, was to bring democracy to that country. Number one, they don't have weapons of mass destruction. Number two, North Korea has popped up and does have them, in part as a reaction to our war in Iraq. The same thing in Iran, where they have, as you mentioned, a nuclear program underway. And instead of getting democracy in Iraq, what we're facing right now is actually anarchy.
But there have been other wars. For example, the war that brought Pol Pot down in Cambodia. There's Kosovo, Afghanistan. There have been any number of other or threats of war, like in East Timor, that have brought freedom to people. So doesn't war have a place in the whole mix, even if you don't think that one particular war might?
It has a shrinking role. I mean, I'm really tracing an evolution that, goes back really to the beginning of the modern age and certainly to the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, look at the top levels of warfare. Back in 1914, you had five or six great powers, perfectly able of going to war, and they did go to war, of fighting, and with one side defeating the other with immense political consequences for the future. Same thing in the Second World War. But with the rise of nuclear weapons, that entire dimension of warfare was stalemated. It became impossible. Instead, we entered into the era of mutual assured destruction. And contrary to what people think, by the way, that era has not ended. Even tiny North Korea has proven able to deter the soul superpower, some say even hyperpower, with a large conventional arsenal and just a few nuclear weapons. So these rules have not been suspended, as some people imagine.
Well, the United Nations was formed to get us past war, but we dropped the bomb months before it was created. Didn't that automatically make the United Nations kind of superfluous?
Well, the United Nations had a very surprising fate, because in the interval between the moment of its planning in the summer of 1945, early summer, May, and its actual foundation in the fall in San Francisco of that year, the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima.
August 6th.
On August 6th. And that really transformed the whole geopolitical picture in that interval between the planning and the founding, with the result that the problem that the UN was chiefly created to solve, namely to prevent great power war, was radically transformed. And in a certain way, the nuclear weapon, when the great arsenals of the Cold War were built on the two sides, played in a kind of horrendous way the role of stalemating war that the UN had proved unable to
perform. The mutually assured destruction, MAD, that actually was more of a deterrent than any conversation anyone had at the UN.
Well, it certainly was, because the UN was, of course, immediately paralyzed by the rise of the Cold War and the struggle between the Soviet Union and the United States. So it was a system really of collective security to be guaranteed by the great powers, the victors of the Second World War, but those victors almost immediately fell out with one another. So with or without the nuclear weapon, the UN could not be an instrument for bringing world peace as it had been envisioned.
You began this book in the last days of the Cold War, didn't you, 12 years ago?
I did indeed.
You've been obviously distracted during those years and done other things, including a book or two, right?
Yes, I have.
But how has the world changed? The UN then was watching as the Soviet Empire fell apart, and you would have thought with the end of the Cold War, the UN would have become a much more important body.
Well, for several years it did. And you had, UN actions in Cambodia and Nicaragua and many parts of the world that were, in fact, quite successful. More recently in East Timor, still that is a very successful operation. And of course, the reason for that was that for a brief period, the Security Council permanent powers, each of whom has a veto, were on the same page in many crises. In fact, they were in the first Gulf War, to give another example. But really, I think all of that changed on September 11th, if not before, because the United States really took its marbles and went home from the UN. And if the greatest power in the world doesn't care to commit itself to the decisions of the Security Council, then it becomes dysfunctional, just as it was during the Cold War.
Well, the president warned that the United Nations would become irrelevant if they didn't go along with what the United States was proposing. So has it become irrelevant? Is Richard Perle right in saying that the fantasy of the UN as a new world order is now dead?
Well, as I say, if the United Nations is not a country like France or Germany, then the United Nations is the assembled representatives of the governments of the earth, and of particular importance being the members of the Security Council. Its success is conditioned on agreement among those powers. If the United States steps in and starts to dictate to the other powers, call them irrelevant and all the rest, then it dies at that moment. There's no possibility that it can work. Now, of course, maybe you want to blame this on the French or on the Russians or the Germans or what have you, but the fact is, if you can't find agreement among the Security Council powers, there's no use wagging your finger at something called the UN, because that is the UN.
But doesn't the UN also bear some of the blame? For example, how can we take it seriously when Cuba is reelected to the Human Rights Commission at the same time that it's clamping down on the human rights of its citizens very openly.
Well, you know, in matters of democracy and liberty, these absurdities do crop up because, you know, you have a lot of governments in there that are not democracies and are presiding over issues of human rights. That is a nonsensical aspect of things that's going to arise from time to time. But, you know, once again, to blame the UN per se is a little bit beside the point because we are the UN. Not only did American President Franklin Delano Roosevelt really promote the thing more than anyone else, along with Winston Churchill, it really came out of an agreement between them. But we are a country in the UN as much as France or Germany or any other country is. So once again, the idea of blaming the UN for something, I don't mean that it's all our fault necessarily, but you have to look to the countries involved. They're the ones who shoulder the blame. If they can't get together and agree on things, then it's dysfunctional. It's not going to work.
Haven't you also proposed the creation of a new democratic league, which would be different from the United Nations because only democracies would be allowed membership?
Not as a replacement for the UN. I think there must be a body, and the UN is that body, in which all nations are represented, whether they are democratic or not. So really what I'm talking about is a kind of democratic caucus or some kind of independent organization.
And of course, here, democracy is a very fluid concept, too.
Well, it is, and yet I think we can define it tolerably well. You know, I won't go through it. Free elections, certain basic liberties, rule of law. And the reason I suggest that, well, there are really two reasons. One is that, you know, as many scholars have pointed out, democracies tend to go to war with one another less than other countries. And if that were formalized in a kind of agreement, then it would become a sort of peaceful bloc that I think could serve as an example to the world, as a sort of foundation or a base. But the other one is equally important. And right now is even more important because democracy is the antithesis of imperialism. Imperialism is rule by force. It is domination. No force, no empire. A federal system is something quite different. Democracy means the consent of the people. Therefore, a key and an absolutely essential component of any League of Democracies would be resolute opposition to and forbidding any imperial activity.
Jonathan Schell is my guest. His latest book, The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People, from Metropolitan Books. Stay with us. We're back with Jonathan Schell, who is currently the Harold Willens Peace Fellow at the Nation Institute. His book, The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People, is published by Metropolitan Books. Now, nonviolence is an idea that's been around a long time. We associate Gandhi with it. We also associate Martin Luther King Jr., and it's recognized as having some kind of effectiveness, but not total effectiveness.
Well, I think that actually nonviolent action has played an immensely important role and underappreciated role in the 20th century. Just consider the fall of the Soviet Union. I mean, I think you'll recall that, 10 years before the Soviet Union collapsed, really, just about everybody believed that that thing was going to be around for the lives of our children and grandchildren. Well, not only has it disappeared today from the face of the earth, but that happened really without significant bloodshed. It's just an amazing thing.
Not because of nonviolent action, or simply because the country was a Potemkin village being held up by spit and bubblegum.
Yes, it's easy now to say that, but remember that back in the 1980s, we were hearing that the Soviet Union was about to take over the world. Yes, it did turn out to have immense weaknesses that were underappreciated at the time, and yet the specific activity, the specific political activity that initiated its fall really was a mass nonviolent movement. I'm thinking especially of the Solidarity movement in Poland, which brought into relief that underlying weakness. And it spread, of course, to Czechoslovakia with Václav Havel, Hungary, and through there into Lithuania, the sort of border republics, and finally on into Russia itself, where Boris Yeltsin won an election. And a very important part of that was that really Gorbachev did adopt, as it turned out, he had a kind of belief in nonviolence that was very much based on his experience that force did not work as a method of ruling society as it had not under the totalitarian regime. So if the resistance to the Soviet Empire had been violent, then I don't think there would have been any chance that you would have had the nonviolent response on Gorbachev's side, perestroika, glasnost, and all of that, which was not, of course, meant to dissolve the Soviet Union. He thought he was reforming it. And yet all of those things together did turn out to lead to its collapse. Of course, it's not the only thing that was going on there, but that was the political part of it. Amazing thing. And I think it's very underappreciated. I think we need to ponder that. I think we need to ask ourselves now, you know, how was it that this empire that had nuclear weapons, it had the Red Army, it had the KGB, it had all the instruments of control and violence in spades, and yet it melted away in the face of a popular movement that scarcely used violence at all, really not at all. That's something we need to ponder, and we need to figure the answers into our conceptions and understanding of what power is. After all, the Soviet Union was supposed to be powerful. Now it's no more. What happened? What was the power? What was the force that brought it down? We need to think about that.
And then when Solidarity comes to power, it fails as a ruling concept as well.
Well, yes, but to me that's not so very significant thing because they ushered in a parliamentary system, you know, much as in the rest of Europe. That was their achievement. The fact that they couldn't win as a party within that system is for me a kind of detail of history.
And then the collapse of the Soviet Union set adrift enough enriched plutonium and uranium for some 70,000 bombs. Many countries... in fact, there's been a lot of talk about secret trade. I realize that is not, you should not blame the fall of the Soviet Union on that, but that instead of making the world feel safer as a result of the end of the Cold War, you're suggesting that it actually has made it a bit more dangerous.
Well, in a sense it has. I mean, in one sense, of course, there was a huge increment in safety, which is that the political hostility between Moscow and Washington that had fueled the Cold War dissolved, and therefore...
Well, some missiles are still aimed at each other,
well,
aren't they?
Well, you know, we have to remember that there are, you know, about 6,000 warheads, strategic warheads, 7,000 on both sides. So technically speaking, we're still in that absurd mutual assured destruction situation, which is a crazy business considering we're friends with the Russians. Nevertheless, certainly those are less likely to be used under current circumstances because of political easing than they were before. So there was a gain, but the problem there was, of course, that the Soviet Union, now Russia, really has very poor control, as you say, over its nuclear materials, and there is a significant danger they will spread to other countries.
But who really would be able to use them? Against the United States. Our biggest fear is terrorists. Terrorists would find it very difficult to put together an effective nuclear device. You need a national program, don't you?
No, I don't think so. It is difficult. I mean, the difficult part with in nuclear weapons is getting the enriched uranium or the plutonium. But if you can steal that, especially the uranium, then the construction of a bomb is not such a difficult thing. With plutonium, it's a little difficult because you have to create certain explosive lenses that compress it. But with uranium, if you just get enough of it and slam two pieces together fast enough in a tube, you'll get a critical reaction and some kind of an atomic explosion. So once they've got the nuclear material, they'd be well on the way to a bomb. Look at what happened in Pakistan. Pakistan is a nuclear power. Several of its scientists went off and met with Osama bin Laden. before September 11th. And
where is he now, Osama bin Laden?
Well, I wouldn't know, Leonard. Do you
maybe
know?
Maybe George Bush knows.
Well, I don't know. Maybe he's in a cave somewhere with Saddam Hussein, and maybe they'll soon release a joint tape.
In response to the nuclear arms race and the 20th century superpower military presence, you write of an antithetic kind of war called the People's War, where the losers refuse to bow to the conqueror. Is that what we're seeing in Iraq right now?
I think we are seeing something like that there. You know, one of the great lessons of the 20th century is that peoples want to determine their own destinies. And even if they're going to have a dictator, they want it to be a domestic dictator. They want it to be their own dictator. I mean, we hope it wouldn't be a dictator. But they really are very, very reluctant to take orders from outside. That was the lesson of the Vietnam War. The Soviets had to learn that in Afghanistan. The British had to learn it all over the world. Now, I don't think that that verdict in favor of self-determination and against empire has suddenly been suspended because the United States has decided that it wants to find some weapons of mass destruction and is going to do regime change in Iraq. I think that verdict lasts, and therefore, to my mind, the real war begins now in Iraq. You know, as a reporter, as a journalist, I would say, you know, we always knew the tanks could go to Baghdad. And then Saddam Hussein would have to leave his palace. That was always known. Even those who opposed the war, as I did and do, knew that much. But what I always believed was that really the future of that country is going to depend on what the people there themselves want. And that's very complicated. We don't even know what that is yet.
And how can we know what people really want? For example,
they'll tell you.
Well, for example,
they'll get out in the streets, they'll shout about it. Yeah.
It means one thing in one place. It meant the Cultural Revolution in China. People thought that they were fighting a war for good in China.
Well, that was still under a totalitarian regime. Don't forget that was launched by Mao. It was in support of Mao. I don't think it was really an example.
So is Vietnam a better case where hearts and minds were never really won over?
Absolutely. It was Vietnam was definitely a place where the local people had a very clear idea, for better or worse. This was not a sweet crowd, you know, the North Vietnamese government or the NLF. They practiced terror themselves. Nevertheless, they had placed themselves at the head of the nationalistic and movement for determination in that country, which accorded with the will of that people to be free of foreign rule. And so that wasn't a case where the hearts and minds of the people, as I say, for better or worse, were against the United States.
My guest is Jonathan Schell. His latest book, The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. It's published by Metropolitan Books. This is WNYC. I'm Leonard Lopate. We're at 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Recently, I read a French thinker from around the time of the French Revolution, Joseph Joubert, and one of the things he wrote thinking about the French Revolution was that if you try to impose a government on a people who have had a nation for a while, unless it's the will of the people, it will not work. And I thought, well, he was talking about the French Revolution and the terror and Napoleon afterward, but this has been proven true again and again, and yet people keep on trying to make the same mistake.
Well, they do try, and the French did try it in Belgium shortly after their revolution, and they quickly learned that revolution from abroad, so to speak, at the point of a bayonet, was not the same as revolution at home in accord with the will of the local people. But you have to add, you know, that imperialism was a highly successful enterprise for a couple of hundred years, and it was a long, long struggle and process of discovery and resistance and fighting violently and nonviolently that finally taught the lesson that empires cannot stand, that they are infeasible in our time. And I think that's as true today for the United States as it was in the long run for the British, let's say, in the first half of the 20th century. So I think we're heading down a path that's not only wrong and destructive, it's unworkable and it's a losing path.
Well, Ian Ferguson just wrote a book defending the British Empire and making connections with what's going on with the United States. We many Americans predicted that the Iraqis would welcome us with open arms, be thrilled that we have liberated them, and are surprised by how much resistance there is in Iraq. I mean, weren't we freeing them from an awful situation?
Well, there was welcome because a really repulsive dictator who had murdered many thousands of people was overthrown, and there was gladness about that. But then came another and quite separate and independent question, which is what follows. Because after all, you have to have a government that, you know, the United States got to Iraq to practice regime change. You know, I like to say that when I change my shirt, before I take off the shirt I'm wearing, I better have a new shirt to put on. And we arrived in Baghdad without any government. I don't know what on earth they had in mind. But they had no administration, no police, nothing for the electricity, the water, and so forth. They had this guy, General Jay Garner, coming in. It proved he couldn't accomplish any of these tasks. They had to yank him out. Now they put in this new guy, Bremer. So they, as I say, they were politically clueless, it seems. It seems not even to have crossed their mind that there was anything to do but to overthrow the government of Saddam Hussein. It was an amazing omission.
The Senate is about to vote on supporting the administration's request to repeal a current law banning the creation of new low-yield nuclear weapons. How do you think that's going to go?
Well, that's an amazing thing. You know, one of the main themes of this book I've just written is that it's really impossible to stop the spread of nuclear weapons by force. Now, look at what's happened in the Senate there. The Senate Armed Services Committee has said, well, we're going to remove a ban on having small nuclear weapons. At the same time, the Bush administration is talking about using nuclear weapons first and using them even preemptively against other countries. Now, imagine the message that that sends out across the world to would-be proliferators. They are looking down a nuclear gun barrel. Do you think they're going to listen to lectures from us seriously about not getting nuclear weapons? And in fact, you may have noticed that just the other day, President Putin in Russia, has announced that it's cranking up its tiny nukes at the same time. So this is a direct result.
Slate magazine recently posted a story called Donald Rumsfeld's Dr. Strangelove about Keith Payne, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Forces Policy. He's a top Pentagon civilian official who's in charge of developing and planning the possible use of nuclear weapons. And he made a name for himself 20 years ago by saying that nuclear war is winnable.
You know, that was almost insanely wrong at the time that it was said, when you were looking at a Soviet arsenal of 25,000 nuclear weapons, 30,000, which could blow up the United States 75 times over. But look, even now, when tiny little North Korea, pops up and says it's got two or three nuclear weapons, whether they do or not is not clear, but they say they do, that can be fired, let's say, at Seoul or at Tokyo. That is enough right there, as I said, to stop the great superpower in its tracks. So the idea of a winnable nuclear war is, it's a desperate illusion.
Well, you place an awful lot of faith in the will of the people. Americans are not outraged by any of this. It's in the newspapers. 7 out of 10 Americans support the administration's policies. Almost down along the board, except on the economy. So what does that say about the will of the people in contrast to the way you think things should be?
Well, the public opinion is not always wise. It's always a struggle. It's always a fight to prevail in public opinion. People thought the Vietnam War was just fine until about 1968. It had been going for 4 or 5 years. So there's no magic in the fact that people believe something. It doesn't mean it's right if they do think it. It's a debate. It's an argument with one's fellow citizens. I happen to think this war is a terrible mistake and that the whole policy is heading us into disaster. So it's an argument I have to have with my fellow citizens. But they must decide. It shouldn't be the people in the administration who are deciding, or the news media, or anyone else. It should be the public. If they want to have this war, then they should have it. If they don't want it, as I think is correct, then they should protest it and resist it, I do.
There seems to be a big gap across the world. In a poll taken by Time Europe recently, 83% of Europeans find the United States to be the biggest threat to world peace. Iraq, North Korea only received 6% of the vote each. So we have different ideas of what is dangerous and what isn't.
This is
world.
A fantastic defeat for the United States. And again, it underscores this distinction that I try to draw in my book between military power and political power. Now, look what we've done. With military power, the United States has won Iraq. In the meantime, we were losing the world. Now, is that a good deal? Is the United States better off for that?
Jonathan Schell's book is The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. It is published by Metropolitan Books. Thank you so much for being with us
today.
Thank
you so much.